And now from the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Most of us don't make the Hall of Fame in any category. Bill Bradley's a Hall of Famer in two, both sports and politics. The former New Jersey senator and presidential candidate played a very meaningful and productive role in public life for decades. That came after a celebrated career as one of the greatest college basketball players in history, as an Olympic champion, and a key member of one of the greatest teams in NBA history, the New York Knicks of the early 70s. Throughout, Bill Bradley earned a reputation for thoughtful reflection. And now those qualities are on display for all to see in a terrific new one-man show, Bill Bradley, Rolling Along, which you can catch on Max. I sat down with Bradley this week to talk about his film, his life, and lessons learned. Bill Bradley, it is always good to see you.
Great to see you, David.
I have to say, I told you before we were rolling, speaking of rolling, that I saw your one-man play, now a film called Rolling Along, and I was really stunned by it. It's delightful, and it's profound, and it's moving, but it's not what you expect from a politician, and it's not what you necessarily expect from Bill Bradley, who had a reputation, to be fair, as somewhat aloof as a politician. Introspection is not the thing that you associate with politicians.
Right. Yeah. I hear what you're saying.
What moved you to do this very, very revealing memoir on a stage and filled with vulnerabilities and candor? And you talk about the anguish associated with learning about a girlfriend's abortion. You talk about the dissolution of your marriage. You talk about things that are very personal.
Well, that's true, David. And I did it because I want this. My hope is that this might have a healing effect on a country that's divided. And I wanted to tell my personal story with great candor in hopes that other people would tell their stories. And the cumulative effect of all those stories is the American story that is underlined by our common humanity that is often missed in politics. And so I did it for that reason, as well as the fact, the idea caught my imagination. I mean, I gave my papers to Princeton, for example, and they did an oral history. And they interviewed 70 people, and I invited all 70 to a reception. 40 showed up, and I stood up and told stories about each of the 40. And one of them was a guy that produced 72 plays on Broadway, Manny Eisenberg, friend of 50 years. And afterwards, he came up to me and he said, "Sounds a little bit like Hal Holbrook doing Mark Twain. You want to work something up?" And yeah, that caught my imagination. I'd like to work something up. I love telling stories. And so I wrote it over the following year. I then took it to 20 cities around the country and workshopped it, reading it and gave people's responses. And then COVID hit. We weren't going to do any theaters. And so I ended up doing it as a film. And I actually think it's better as a film.
Yeah, you did it in front of an audience, but as a film. You know, the thing that struck me, my first exposure to you, like most people of my age, was not through politics, but sports. And I was just a young kid. And I don't know at what point I read A Sense of Where You Are, which was this wonderful, first an essay in The New Yorker, and then a book by John McPhee, who I think that launched his career, became one of the great nonfiction writers of our time. But the thing that that book underscores was just how assiduously you prepared yourself to be a basketball player. Practice and the exercises that you created for yourself, often alone, just working to develop that sense of where you are. I guess this is more a sense of where I've been. But it sounds like getting ready to do this show those same qualities were at play.
No question about it. No question about it. So I wrote it, and then I read it in 20 cities and took notes and rewrote and rewrote. So then I said, well, okay, now if I'm going to do this on the stage, do I have to memorize it? And yeah, you got to memorize it. So I was walking around Central Park for a couple of months memorizing it. And then once you've memorized it, you have to keep sharp, right? You have to keep your shot sharp. And so every day at 3:30 in the rec room of the apartment building we live in New York, I did it. And it kind of got around. Sometimes two people showed, sometimes four people showed, sometimes 14, sometimes four, sometimes zero. I'd do it anyway. 3:30, I had to go hit my 20 shots in a row.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really striking. So let's talk about the story that you tell here. And one of the things that struck me was a theme that runs through is this notion of belonging and wanting to belong, and that you struggled to find that. You were an only child.
Yeah.
You were the son of a banker in an industrial town where most of the people worked at the plate plant or whatever it was, the glass plant. Talk about that.
Yeah, there's no question. The theme is being different and not belonging. There's an element of that. Maybe that's in a lot of lives. When I had this finished, I showed it to 50 people around the country and watched them watch it. Then we did a focus group of 15, and the guy who did the focus group really knew what he was doing. So he said to the people, what is this about? And they said, it's about all of us. It's about love of the game, love of the country, forgiveness, perseverance. It's about triumph, defeat, sadness, joy. It's about life. And one of the themes of my life was that I didn't feel that I belonged. Where I grew up, my father was the local banker. I was the banker's son. All of my classmates were factory worker sons in a plate glass factory. And then I got to Princeton. I was an evangelical Christian in a primarily secular, very secular university. And again, I didn't feel like I belonged. I felt different. And it was only when I got with the Knicks and we put the team together and the team was put together, that gelled, that I felt I belonged. And I felt, well, I finally found my home with my teammates on the road and in New York with the Knicks. And the reason I felt that was because you have to give up so much of yourself and everybody gives it up at the same time. And that's the way you become a great team. You can't do it on your own. No one player is as great as all five.
Your friend Phil Jackson always quotes this Native American line that the strength of the pack is the wolf and the strength of the wolf is the pack.
Right.
Which is very much what you're talking about. I want to talk more about that in a second, but I want to stick with your childhood and your parents. There's a point in this piece, later in this piece, in which you said, the only time your mother complimented you was when she was on her deathbed, and she said, "Bill, you've been a good boy," and you note to the laughter of the audience. I was 52 years old, but there was a poignancy behind all of that, and it's one that I kind of related to. I had a complicated relationship with my own mother, who was very much invested in my success. And I always felt like her affection was
conditional.
Yes. Conditional, which is not good. You don't want to feel like love is conditional to success, but I presume that you said your father wanted you to be a gentleman and your mother wanted you to be a success.
And neither one wanted me to be a basketball player.
Yeah. I remember actually it wasn't in this play. I remember you telling this joke about maybe when you were still active in politics, about coming home in the off season to visit, and every year, and your father saying, "When are you going to get a real job? When are you going to get a real job?" And then you told him what you were being paid, and he said, "Well, that's a real job,
not a bad job."
Yeah, not a bad job. But back to your mom, is that where this drive comes from? That this sort of compulsion to succeed, to excel?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, I think that was true. My father had clear standards. It was obvious what his standards were. So I was trying to live up to my father's standards. But at the same time, my mother was the active parent because my father had a disability, calcified arthritis of the lower spine. I never saw him drive a car, tie his shoes, or put his jacket on. So my mother was left to do a lot of that. And, you know, she was the one that sat at the piano bench with me, making sure that I practiced, you know. So there was that element. But this became locked into my personality when I was about 14. And I went to a basketball camp that was sponsored by Easy Ed McCauley, who was basketball player
from the old St. Louis Hawks.
And he said to the assembled campers that one day, remember, if you're not practicing, somebody somewhere is practicing. And given roughly equal ability, if you two meet, he's going to win. That was a light bulb that went off in my head. And I said, I'm never going to lose because I didn't put the time in. And that was the origin of my workaholism. Uh-huh. And it was easily transferred from basketball to school to politics to whatever, to doing this show. You know, it's just the way you live. That's how you are. And that discipline became a very fundamental part of my life.
Let me ask you just one last question. I don't want to belabor this point, but was that painful that your mom never complimented you? I mean, you were arguably the greatest college basketball player ever. Certainly at that moment, that was the case. Lou Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar came along after. He may have quibbled with you on that, but was it hurtful?
No, it wasn't. It's strange because I didn't really pine for her compliments, right? I mean, I just took life the way it was. And what life was, you had to have discipline and you had to do well and so forth. It was only on her deathbed when she said, "You've been a good boy," that it struck me. And I thought, oh, yeah, I never heard that before. And it was at that moment that it sunk in. It was not something that I was even aware of as a kid. I knew my mother was a disciplinarian, like her father had been before, but I didn't have enough self-awareness growing up to say, well, gee, I wish I had something I didn't have. And I was very lucky. In retrospect, I was very lucky to have the parents that I had.
Did it affect the way you parented?
I tell my daughter I love her a lot.
So talk about, you mentioned your faith. That was a big part of your life when you were growing up, and the oddity of being an evangelical Christian at Princeton. But tell me what that meant to you. How did that play a role in your early life?
It was an essential part of who I was. And, you know, this took place. I became evangelical when I was in high school. And it became the focus of my life. I taught Sunday school. I went to Bible study classes off campus. I proselytized. I remember when we were in the Olympics in 1964 in Tokyo, I figured we'd end up playing the Soviet Union in the finals. So the athletes all ate in a kind of common facilities. And so I got to know this Russian, the Soviet player who was a guard. And so one day, because I was concerned for him or I cared about him, I went into Tokyo to a Bible store and bought a Bible, translated into Russian, and brought it back and gave it to him. And I said, "Here, this is from me to you." He kind of looked puzzled, but that's what I did in those years, you know?
Yeah. And then at some point, you talked about this. You made a decision as to, and you walked away from that. Why?
Billy Graham, who was a man that I respected and knew, asked me to speak at his crusade when I was in London. And it was at Earl's Court, 5,000 people giving a testimony I've given all over the country for many years. And I did, but that was the last time. And I came to feel that God's love was more important than God's judgment. And it just took me away from the evangelical path to a different way.
And what do you make of the evangelical movement today? You know, I did I had a great conversation here a couple of months ago with Tim Alberta, who's a wonderful, I think one of the great journalists in our country. And he wrote, his father was an evangelical pastor. And Tim wrote about this. He's a political writer, and he wrote about the sort of evolution or devolution of the evangelical church from Falwell to the current day, when it has become much more political. And I'm wondering how you look at it from the vantage point of someone who once was part of the movement.
Well, it's much different than what I experienced. I mean, people were interested in your faith and in your belief in your soul, and politics was really not a big part of it at all. It was all religion, and it was deeply meaningful to me. And, you know, part of what I say in the show, which I hope we'll get to, one of the lines that's repeated three times in the show is never look down on people you don't understand. And part of that in my own mind was never look down on someone who's evangelical, partly because I was and I experienced people looking down on me because I was evangelical, like the assistant dean, the chaplain at Princeton, who looked down on me because I was evangelical. So never do that. But I think that the movement has become extremely political. There's a book by a guy named Jeff Sherritt called Undertow that describes the turn in evangelicalism. And so I think that there are plenty of people out there who are evangelical, just like I was. But then there are others who've turned it into a political movement, and they put things together that don't make any sense whatsoever. And you think, what? And yet they seem to believe it.
You were a very sought-after high school basketball player, and you had the opportunity to go to any number of places. And you were headed to Duke, and at the last minute, you diverted to Princeton. Why?
Well, short answer is I wanted to be a diplomat, and you do that better at Princeton than at Duke. But that's not the real answer. The real answer is after I signed a scholarship to go to Duke, athletic scholarship, my mother was very pleased, good Methodist school, right? My father was quiet. And he said, I think you ought to take a trip to Europe. You never graduated from high school. So he sent me on a trip to Europe, and there were 13 women and me on a trip. And they couldn't understand why I was going to go to Duke when I could go to Princeton, Yale. They didn't have any idea about basketball, right? And when I came back from that trip, I played baseball, broke my foot, and contemplated the world without basketball, as you always do when you're injured. Maybe this is it, right? And said, okay, if I don't have basketball, where do I want to go to school? I'm going to go to Princeton, not Duke. And so that was late in the game. The Princeton class convened on a Monday morning, the Duke class on a Wednesday. And on Friday night, the previous Friday, I came home from a date, woke my parents up and said, look, I want to go to Princeton, not to Duke. And so they called an alumnus, who called the admission office at Princeton. And I got to Princeton around 10 p.m. on Sunday night. And was in the freshman class at 8 a.m. in the morning.
And by the end of your freshman year, you were probably pretty well known on that campus. And again, just I'm thinking back to that period of time. I'm a bit younger than you, but I was old enough to follow basketball. And you don't talk really about this. But I wonder what it was like to get the kind of attention, to have a guy write what would become a book about you while you were still a college student, and to get all this attention. And the reason I've been thinking about it a lot lately, Bill, is I've been watching this young woman, Caitlin Clark, this player at Iowa. And as I was thinking about this conversation, I was thinking, she must have some sense of what it was like for you back then.
I became a kind of minor celebrity in college. I was getting 55 letters a day, which is not peanuts, but it's not overwhelming. It's certainly not...
Before social media. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I had to come to terms with that. And that's one of the things that I did when I went to Oxford. One of the reasons I valued Oxford, because there, who could care? I mean, my tutors didn't know what basketball was, right? And so it was a it was a good time. There was a book I read called The Image by Daniel Boorstin that I also thought really helpful in putting the whole thing in perspective.
Yeah. Have you seen her play, by the way? Caitlin Clark, have you seen her play?
She's unbelievable. She's a
range
for a three-point shot. She could shoot it at half court. She almost did the other day. I saw one flip.
I know. The thing about her, and that sort of reminds me of you, is the precision with which she plays, and not her shooting, but her passing.
Yeah. She's a great player and passer and shooter, and she doesn't need much room to get it off. And so I think she's a tremendous player. I enjoy watching her.
The women's game generally, to me, is an interesting game because they can't overpower each other.
Yeah.
And so they actually play the game the way the game's meant to be played.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, back to the show.
While you were at Princeton, you spent some time in Washington as an intern or a page.
I was an intern in Washington in the summer of 1964 and happened to be in the Senate chamber the night the 1964 Civil Rights Act passed, the one that desegregated public accommodations. In other words, those hotels and grounds that were segregated in my Missouri childhood.
Yeah.
That was an important year in that regard.
Oh my gosh, I mean, a historic year, and you were there. 15 years later, you would be there as a United States Senator. What were your thoughts when you saw this momentous thing, historic thing, happening?
It's actually the way I became a Democrat. I mean, my father was Republican. He was an elector for Tom Dewey in 1948, and I grew up a Republican. Therefore, when I was at Princeton. I was an intern. I was in this chamber the night the 1964 Civil Rights Act passed. And I saw the Republican nominee for president, Barry Goldwater, stand and vote against it. And at that moment, I became a Democrat. And so it was a very important year for me in many ways because, you know, ultimately, I think we all have to ask ourselves what we owe another human being simply because that person is a human being. And as I looked at the sweep of history, I mean, I saw that, you know, there was a time when the elderly didn't have health care or a pension, when the Great Lakes were industrial sewers, when, you know, African-Americans and women didn't have a right to vote, and when companies did whatever they wanted to their workers or to their customers. But political leadership changed those things. And that came through to me in a very profound way in that summer of 1964. Embodied in the Civil Rights Act, where progress was made by politicians in a Senate chamber. And I think I thought to myself, well, maybe someday I can be here and help make the world a better place.
The night that the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010.
Yeah.
I've told this story here before, but I have a child with chronic illness, epilepsy, and we almost went bankrupt trying to cover her expenses when I was a young reporter. And I went into my office and I wept the night that that bill passed. And it wasn't because it was a political victory.
No, no.
Yeah. And I went and I found President Obama and I said, I want to thank you on behalf of all the families like mine who won't have to go through the terror that we did of you know, weighing how we save our kids and stay solvent. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, that's why we do the work.
Yeah.
And it was like the most clarifying thing anybody's ever said to me about, you know, we get so caught up in the red and blue and who's up and who's down. And it's like, that's not the important thing. The important thing is what you can get done for people.
Yeah, no question about that.
But let me ask you about race. You know, you were there when the Civil Rights Act passed. One of the moving things that you recounted in this show of many was about your teammate and a guy I watched as a kid, Dick Barnett.
I learned a lot more from my black teammates than they learned from me, I'll tell you that. And Dick Barnett, who his all-black Tennessee State team won the national championship, flew back to Nashville, went right from the airport to a lunch counter sit-in downtown Nashville, where he had to have the discipline not to respond when white people spit on him for protesting a segregated restaurant. I mean, that's just one among many stories that I heard from my teammates about being black in America. And, you know, things move forward, thank God. But it made a deep impression on me. More the story of an African-American rookie from Mississippi who says he'll always vote because for 150 years his family was denied a right to vote. Or Cassie Russell was on a drive down from Ann Arbor to Detroit where we had an off-day practice on the road. He was late and he was fined. And because you're always fined if you're late. And then we're in the practice about 10 minutes and he gets in a fight with a white rookie. And Willis, African-American captain, tries to break it up. And Cassie says, Uncle Tom. Only later did I realize that Cassie's lateness and foul mood came from being stopped by Michigan State police on his way down from Ann Arbor and forced to light spread eagle on the hood of his car as his trunk and back seat were searched. So, you know, there's no question that through my black teammates, I saw their distrust and their of white Americans. I heard the stories that they told about their lives. And I saw how far we have to go as a country before our racial reality matches our ideals. And above all, I saw how much I'll never know because I'm white. But I was privileged to have that experience.
Where do you think we are now?
I think we made a lot of progress. I think we can always go further. I mean, this is an issue ultimately of the human heart. There are laws that can be passed and should be passed. But we have a good architecture of civil rights laws now. And, you know, there are things that we could continue to do. But I think that we've made a lot of progress.
You talked about going to Oxford, the culmination of your college career. I think, do you still hold the scoring record for the NCAA? You scored 58 points in an NCAA. I remember the game.
Yeah.
I think you may still have the record. But then you went off to Oxford. I guess you were drafted by the Knicks.
Yeah, then I went to Oxford, and I was at Oxford. And for my first year there, I played with an Italian meatpacking firm in the European Cup championships. And we won the European Cup, but I then didn't play basketball.
You sort of explained it earlier, but why did you? A lot of people would say, well, I'm at the top of my game. I'm highly regarded. I could make a lot of money. I'm going to go play basketball. What made you go to Oxford?
On that trip I described to you, my father sent me on when I was in high school with 13 women. One of the places we stopped was Oxford. And it was a beautiful June afternoon. I walked in the quad of Christ Church, one of the colleges, and thought to myself as I looked around, I got to find a way to get back here. And then I read about something called a Rhodes Scholarship. I applied for it and got it. And so the reality was I was headed to Oxford no matter what was going on in basketball because it had been a part of me for at least 4 years.
Did they try to dissuade you? Did people try and dissuade you?
No, they knew that it would not work, so they didn't try.
And you also served in the Air Force Reserve in that period,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I was in the Air Force Reserve 6 years. Yeah, about 6 years, yeah.
One thing that strikes me, and you didn't talk that much about it in this show, but the 60s were one of the most turbulent decades in our history. You were a young person in the 60s and a well-known young person. How did you navigate all of that? The war, the civil rights movement, student protests?
Well, the student protests actually came the second half of 60.
The 60, that's true, yes.
Now, I was at Oxford during that time and then with the Knicks. In my off seasons as a Knick, I would do things that I thought I'd try to make the world a better place. I mean, you know, I worked in Washington in the poverty program in OEO one summer. I taught reading in a street school in Harlem one summer. And I worked in an advertising firm one summer. And one summer I took a trip all around the world. I mean, we won the world championship in 1970. And 2 weeks later, I was on a trip around the world to try and learn about what was going on. And I always felt that I had an obligation to, make the world a better place.
You felt like you were responding to the call of the times in your own way.
Yeah. It also got mixed up with well-knownness, you know, celebrity, which I was trying to come to terms with. And so I had to do it in a way that was consistent with who I was as a human being and not simply be a star attraction.
Speaking of coming to terms with celebrity, when you did come to New York, and I remember that as well, because I was very much a Knicks fan when you arrived, you were highly paid. I think $150,000 a year, you said in the show, which by today's standards, I think would be $1.4 million, which would be like entry-level pay in the NBA right now. But then it was considered a princely sum of money, and you weren't very good for the first year.
They had me playing guard. I was too slow to play guard. And I had received a large contract, and the crowd turned on me. You know, it was a painful experience. I mean,
New Yorkers can be clear about their feelings.
18,000 people booing you, spitting on you, throwing coins at you, accosting you in the street with Bradley overpaid bum. I mean, nothing in politics really equaled that in terms of the intensity. I've had a lot of tough town meetings where people are shouting and so forth, but not like that. It wasn't so personal. And so I had to learn that happens in life and you have to find a way to cope. And I just kept working. I spent the summer working very hard on my game and came back. And then, of course, Cassie broke his ankle and moved me to forward, which was a natural position. I got to Buescher and the team gelled.
You said that winning in this show, you talk about winning the titles and that you often were asked whether winning a seat in the United States Senate exceeded that. And you were very clear that the answer was no.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, winning a U.S. Senate seat's a great honor, but that simply means you got to work 14 hours a day for 6 years to prove the people were wrong, right? It doesn't compare to standing at center court with your fist raised in the air, chills going up and down your spine, knowing you are the best in the world. So, no, they were two different kinds of experiences, each valuable and each memorable.
Talk about what you learned about leadership from that experience, from being an athlete and being an athlete on those excellent teams.
Well, I learned that it's important to be selfless, unselfish, you know, that's one of the keys. It's important to have discipline. It's important to have imagination, the basic values that you can learn in the game. And, you know, David, I must say, when I look out at the country today and see how divided we are, I think maybe we could, maybe we ought to think back to what made the Knick teams successful so many years ago. I mean, you know, take responsibility for yourself, respect your fellow human being, disagree with them openly, honestly, civilly, enjoy their humanity. And then, as my grandmother used to say, never look down on people you don't understand. And to me, that's what playing the game meant. It meant understanding all of those things as a part of your life and not simply as a part of the game. And I think, quite frankly, it'd be valuable for everybody to have that. I think it'd be an important way to think about how we can put things back together. I mean, you know, another reason I did this film, this show, was I wanted to show that there's a common humanity out there. We all share, right?
Yes.
And it's to get to that level that is the antidote to this brittleness of this blue-red, that type brittleness. And, you know, I mean, I think, for example, you know, we were all taught either by a coach or by our parents that, you know, when you lose, you congratulate the winner. And whether it was in sports, or, you know, Little League or whatever, I think that, you know, you learn to act out of honor, not out of grievance. And you know that if you have humility and you work hard, you can achieve excellence. And if you achieve excellence, you take care of your family. And if enough Americans achieve excellence, the country moves forward in a dramatic way. And so all of those things flow from the experiences over a lifetime, but a lot of it came out of the basketball experience.
You know, the things that you talk about, and there are things that I talk about a lot. I mean, that we've lost our sense of common humanity. And there's a reason for it. Because we have a contemporary environment, a social media culture that thrives on sort of not finding our common humanity, but finding our particular grievances and exploiting them, and that has become very much not just the profit model for social media, but also for politics itself.
Yeah, and you know it's understandable that some people get tuned out because of this. But the point is, you shouldn't tune out. You should reach out. I mean, democracy doesn't work unless you work at it. And somebody once said it's a lunch pail business. Writing a law is a lunch pail business. You got to know the substance. You got to know your opponent. You got to know what they want. You got to get a deal. You got to compromise. And that's the way you move your collective humanity an inch forward. And it all comes down not just to voting, which is absolutely critical, but, you know, getting involved. I mean, we can take control of our life. We don't have to sit back and just let the social media turn us further and further off. We assert those values that we've been taught as kids that we believe in the country can achieve, and we go for it. And to me, that's really an important message, particularly in this year, where the whole goal in some ways is to turn people off, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that is it. It becomes a war of attrition, you know, sort of motivated by the grievance. If you believe in this process as I do, if you believe in democracy, it's a dispiriting time. But let me ask you something that I just want to pick up on something you said. You talked about how laws are made. You went to the Senate. You were a young guy. You probably came there, and there were folks who looked at you and wondered what they were getting. And whether you were there purely as a celebrity, but you were you became a very highly respected member of that body, and you were the driving force, or a driving force, the sponsor of one of the most storied pieces of legislation ever, which was the tax reform of 1986. Which involved working not just with Republicans in the Senate, but also with Ronald Reagan and the Reagan administration, so on. And the goal which you achieved was to lower the tax rates and broaden the base by eliminating a whole bunch of distortions in the tax code that favored individual interests and so on. I mean, it was really an admirable effort. Do you think such a thing is? I mean, we don't see that many examples of that kind of thing today.
You know, when Cory Booker went to the Senate from representing New Jersey, he asked me what he should do. I said, make five Republican friends, really friends, and they'll help you at some point. They'll find a way. And so he did. And one of them was a guy named Imhoff, who was a very conservative senator from Oklahoma.
From Oklahoma, yeah.
Because he got to know Imhoff, he knew he had an adopted child. So he had a foster care bill. He asked Imhoff to sponsor, co-sponsor. He did, and got Republicans to back him. Now, that's not the Tax Reform Act of 1986, but it illustrates that there are still ways that you can, that people, you relate to people as human beings, not as cardboard cutout. And to me, the lesson of tax reform was, you know, you have to, A, analyze the situation and decide what is the answer, okay? And then you have to try to convince people on both sides that that is the answer. That involved with me trying to do that. Sometimes it involved, I even went to the House once to play basketball with some wavering congressman. And then you became Ross Tinkowski's guy. He was the chairman of Ways and Means Committee. You were his senator, right? And then you became. Then you had to win over Bob Packwood, who was a Republican, who was the chairman of the Finance Committee. So you make that happen. And you realize that you're advancing together. And that's the way you move our collective humanity forward. That's the way you get the rates down to 28%. That's the way that you, that's what legislation is. Legislation is about more about ears than it is mouth. And too many politicians think it's about mouth. It's about ears. You listen carefully to what the other person wants, find some way to accommodate as much as you can without giving up what you want, and then you get a law passed. And is that possible today? Well, President Biden did it with the infrastructure bill. He did it a couple of times. So is it possible? Yes, it is still possible. Are there obstacles? Yes, there are plenty of obstacles. But if you have one issue in mind, you have to be single-minded. I remember, you know, I talked about little else but tax reform for 4 years. Every speech I gave, tax reform, tax reform. You might have even heard one or two of them.
Yes, I think I did, yeah.
And I remember one Sunday I was home, and our daughter, who was 9 years old, was in the room. And I was watching myself on a TV show that was recorded on Thursday, rebroadcast on Monday, on Sunday. And so I said, hey, stick around. Dad's going to be on TV. And she hit her little friend and said, come on, let's go. I'll just go talk about her loopholes. That's it. Not all I talked about. But you have to be single-minded to get these things done.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to the show.
We just saw an admirable example of this when a Republican, a conservative Republican, James Lankford, Chris Murphy from Connecticut, who, by the way, did strike a compromise on guns, which hadn't been done for a couple of decades, with Cornyn of Texas a couple of years ago, and is, I think, really a splendid senator. Kyrsten Sinema, who was an independent, and they arrived after painstaking negotiations with among themselves and with the White House on a bill that would have funded Ukraine and funded Israel and would have done significant things to deal with the crisis at the border. And the whole thing got blown up by Donald Trump.
Well, by Donald Trump, yeah.
That is that you had a bunch of Republican senators, including senators like Lindsey Graham, who purports to be a strong hawk and strong on the border and so on, walk away from this thing. What does that tell you about where we are?
Well, it tells me about the Republican Party doesn't think for itself anymore. It's a frightened party, and it's frightened of crossing Trump. And to me, that's a sad comment. And there are plenty of Republicans. I mean, look at what Lynn Cheney's just said about this. Look at what any number. You know, sometimes you have to. Sometimes you have to lose in order to stand up for something. And I do not believe that Republicans would lose if they voted for this package. They're just catering to Trump. They're taking the lowest, you know, the easiest path forward, which is really, in my view, unfortunate. You know, I look at this election. If it comes down to Biden versus Trump, and I say, well, Trump, that would be weak grievance versus competence and kindness. And to me, competence and kindness are what will move this country forward. Weakness and grievance will always get us into trouble.
You served with Joe Biden. He got there 6 years before you, but you obviously know him very, very well. What are your thoughts about him as you see him now?
Well, I remember Joe led a delegation on the first trip I ever took to the then Soviet Union. And we will tell you this one story. And we were meeting in the Kremlin with Alexei Kosygin, who was the world ruler of Russia with Brezhnev at the time of the Soviet Union. And this was at a time where you with some foreign leaders, some Russians, you'd go into the meeting and they end up talking 45 minutes, you have 10 minutes of questions. That wasn't Kosygin. He was kind of an academic or whatever. So we're going back and forth arguing. And at one point, Biden looks across the green felt table top and looks him right in the eye and says, "Come on, Alexei, don't shit a shitter." And you know, that's Joe Biden, irrepressible.
Yeah. He needs, honestly, to show a little more of that now, because the impression, you know, you say weak and grievance versus competence and kindness, but if you polled right now, what you would see is that people see Trump as a strong figure and Biden as a weak figure. And I'm moved by, it was a kind of cynical in some ways, but accurate analysis by Bill Clinton when he said strong and wrong often beats weak and right in American politics. I think this is an issue in this campaign because Biden has done extraordinary things, as you mentioned. You named a couple of them. You know, and there's also the climate bill and the things he's done on healthcare and so on. The things he's tried to do on child poverty, which was an issue that you carried for years and years and years. But you don't do that by being weak. But everything is about how you appear in front of a camera. Do you think there are things that he can do? And let me ask you a question. I mean, you're about his age. Do you think age is a fair issue?
I think that what a president has to do, a president is he has to make decisions. He doesn't have to be a long-distance runner. He doesn't have to be a marathon runner. He has to make decisions. And Joe Biden has made excellent decisions. And I think he would make excellent decisions in his second term. I mean, he has done, as you point out, all the things we can make the list of all the things that he's done, whether it's infrastructure, chips, or whatever. But I think he needs to, what I would say is let Joe Biden be Joe Biden. I think that once, you know, he's managed, or once he's told you can't make this make, you can't do that, then he loses the spontaneity that makes him who he is. And I just keep thinking, let it, you know, don't shit a shitter.
Yeah. So you think he's been overmanaged?
No, I don't think he's been overmanaged. I think that he ought to just be himself. I think that's the way to go. I think his team actually has been very, very good. I think he's got one of the best teams ever. I think that they understand what he likes to do and what he doesn't like to do, and they try to help him achieve his goals, and they and he have been successful.
Just returning to the show, you also talk about your own race for president, which I also remember well, back in 2000. Talk about the experience of running for president, and also talk, as you talk in the show, about the experience of losing a race for president. It was the only race you ever lost.
Yeah. Well, it's a remarkable experience. I was very lucky to have it for a year and a half, which is how long it was that I was running. And I always used to say, you go into a town meeting in Iowa or New Hampshire or someplace, and what I like to do is stitch the eyes together of the people in the town meeting. You know, you could see one moving to another. You'd see what you're saying works with one person but doesn't work with another person, and how you try to get across to that room what you would do if you were the president of the United States. And it's a tremendous honor. And the country is so diverse. And people always say, yeah, human diversity. Yes, that's true. But there's also geographic diversity. I mean, for a number of years, about 8 years, I was the chairman of water and power in the Senate, in charge of water in 20 Western states. Those Western states have lives that are much different than the lives in New Jersey or in Missouri, where I grew up. And so understanding the rhythms of the country, that's why when I was in the Senate, I'd go on what I called American journeys, right? 2 days in a wheat farmer in South Dakota, 2 days in Cajun country, the border at El Paso, steel mill in Ohio. Why did I do that? I did that because I thought it would make me a better senator if I understood the country. And when you're president, all of this is yours. You're not going out to spend 2 days because you have to represent all of this diversity. And to me, that's the real thrill of thinking about how to do that.
One of the challenges we have today is because of the sort of polarization of the country, we don't understand each other very well. And even Democrats, friends of mine, friends of yours, well-intended, but the messages that are being sent to small towns and rural communities like the one in which you grew up and are not sort of respectful messages. They're sort of patronizing messages at times. And I think it hurts the party. And obviously, there's a lot of antagonism coming the other way. And sort of reestablishing the notion that we are part of this fabric and that the team orientation that you spoke of so eloquently earlier, it seems so important now.
That, by the way, it's playing on Max, right?
Yes, I'm going to talk about that, but your publicist will be happy that you said that. Talk about the end of that campaign. You know, you had a challenge because John McCain was running on the Republican side. You guys had a famous debate up in New Hampshire. John McCain took a lot of independents into the Republican column that you were counting on in a Democratic primary, and you lost by 6 points, and that was a pivotal moment. But besides the particulars of it, what was it like to absorb that loss?
It was tough, something you've wanted for many years, but it didn't happen, and it required you to make a major shift. I mean, there's practical, which meant you had to think of what do you do without seeking the presidency, right? Then on a personal level, and then looking deep within yourself. And when I did, you found that, living with understanding your feelings as well as your thoughts was a really important thing. And, you know, when I look out there today, I say, you know, what do I like? Well, I mean, you know, I think what I'm struck with now is just giving kindness to people and seeking and giving forgiveness and the anticipation of what each day will bring. You don't know. And, you know, I work for a company in New York. I have young companies, and these young people, they struggle. So they want to change the world, and they will change the world. One little company might have a new cure to diabetes, for example, and it's exciting, right? But I had to move from thinking of myself as a potential president and then a politician to being something else. And so for 16 years, I've had a radio program on Sirius XM called American Voices, where I interview people about their lives. I've worked at Allen Company and worked with young companies. To me, that's a full experience. But to get there from the defeat, you know, when the defeat occurred, I literally spent months just driving aimlessly around the roads of New Jersey and Northern California, and it took a while.
Yeah. I want to thank you for the causes that you fought for universal healthcare, which is a goal we're still driving toward, for ending child poverty, for gun control. I mean, you were such a strong voice on that issue. And you think about the issues that we're confronting today and the importance of the vision that you had back then still resonates very, very strongly today. So,
well, you know, I appreciate that. And, you know, there's a difference between if you're a basketball player and you win a championship, it's over, right? You won the championship. But in politics, it never ends, because people are always going to get sick, right? Or you always want your elderly parents to have a good life, or you need a job, and therefore it's the continuum of politics that could really be the exciting part of public service.
Well, and I hope that there are a few young people listening to you now who are excited by picking up that torch. I think the most challenging and important issue we face is whether these young people lean in or lean out.
Reach out, don't tune out. And you can shape your own future here. I mean, look at the hall that Trump went to speak to hawk his gold sneakers. He was booked out of the hall because young people who were there knew what he was. And if you put that into politics, that means registering people to vote. That means getting them out to vote. It's a lunch pail job to be a citizen in a democracy, but it's the only thing that deserves your right to be whatever you want to be. And to me, that's what democracy is about. And we're reminded of that tragically by the death of Navalny just in the last week, when he gave his life for democracy. We're not asking young people to give their lives. We're asking them to just stay involved. Register, vote, talk to their friends. Don't let the small thing you disagree with, say, President Biden on, you're never going to agree with anybody 100% of the time. But you have to have in balance which one is going to take the country in the right direction. I mean, you want somebody that gives Russia a green light to invade Europe? Or you want someone who's respected by all leaders in the world because of his competence? And to me, that's one of the other choices.
Well, I can just report to you that having worked for years at the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, that I found it after my years in politics and public life and being exposed to these young people, I have hope. I have faith.
No, I do too.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of young people out there who, as you say, want to change the world for the better. And so even on the worst day, they give me hope. Bill Bradley, Rolling Along is a treasure. It is on Max. I urge everyone to watch it. You are terrific in telling your own story as you are in eliciting other people's stories. And it's always a pleasure to be with you.
David, I feel the same way. You're one of the country's treasures.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Axe Files, brought to you by the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Miriam Fender Annenberg. The show is also produced by Sarah-Lena Berry, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Steve Lichtai and Haley Thomas. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.